Podcast of the cinema.
Where you cannot win. Okay, so it's not Sunday.
No.
It's Wednesday.
Yes.
Sunday, you were traveling. You were not home yet from the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival.
Correct.
Monday, they were jackhammering our sidewalk right in front of our building. There was no... And this happened all day long.
No. That was Tuesday.
No.
Monday was a holiday. You went to see Solo, and then you came back and you were too tired to podcast, so we didn't podcast.
That's right. Solo made me real tired. And then Monday...
Tuesday.
Also, it was a holiday.
Yes.
So, we took a holiday. Just some time to celebrate. Just one day out of life, okay?
It would have been so nice.
Then they jackhammered the street.
Yes.
Now today, they're still jackhammering the street.
Yes.
But a little ways up the street.
Yes.
So you might still hear it.
Probably so.
And then the garbage collection is happening.
It's all happening.
So there's a lot of... Listen, you're just going to hear it.
Yes. Yeah, so if...
What's your name?
If this is your first episode...
Who are you?
Welcome to this craziness. I'm Alonzo Duraldi. I'm the film reviews editor of The Wrap. I'm the co-host of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network and co-host of Who Shot Ya on Maximum Fun.
My name's Dave White. I'm a film critic. Also, I make dinner. I send mugs and t-shirts to Patreon people. We'll talk about that much later. Tell me about the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival.
The Mammoth Lakes Film Festival.
Why did you even go?
I was invited to be a juror.
Yes.
And I was like, where is Mammoth Lakes? And I looked it up on the
computer. It's in this state. It turns out...
It is in California.
It's in California.
And it is...
It's in the top part, where we don't usually go there.
We never go there. But then I realized, it's Mammoth. It's where, like, our friend Gary goes skiing all the time.
Right. And takes ridiculous skiing selfies while he's doing it.
So, gorgeous mountains.
Oh, I'm sorry, Gary. I know you're listening. Really great skiing selfies
the best.
Endear you to everyone.
Happy birthday, by the way.
Yeah.
It was like Yosemite adjacent. I was like, we never go to this part of California because we don't generally have much use for the outdoors.
What's there to do? It's nature. You know what's in nature? Queen snakes. You get chomped by a queen snake, guess what?
You've had it.
That's correct.
So I was invited to this film festival. I was like, cool, I would like to see Mammoth Lakes. So it was fun. I was on the international jury and saw some cool movies, especially the one that we gave the award to, which is a Polish film called Tower, A Bright Day.
Right.
I think it premiered at Berlin this year.
Okay.
And it is really creepy and really unsettling.
Okay.
And I really can't wait for you to see it. I think you'll dig it. But I'm sure someone's going to pick it up and it'll get released. And we'll talk about it more when it comes out. But the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival was very well run and everyone was super nice. And I was very well taken care of. And I would say if you have the chance, go to the Mammoth Lakes Film Festival.
All right. I'm not going to do that.
You're coming up there with me one of these days.
Look, if you did a good enough job as a juror...
Yeah, no, look...
You don't know if they're ever going to ask you back.
Maybe they won't. Maybe
they thought you were sucky at your job.
That they might.
It's possible.
But I would still
probably
like...
Probably not.
I would still like to go there with you.
You're very conscientious.
I would
about
still
this,
like to go to that part of the state with you, because you would like the cold.
I do love it when it's cold.
It was... I was there in May, and it was... Like, it got down to 29 degrees at night.
Really?
Yeah. It was the mountains.
Okay, maybe I would like that. But
yes.
You know what? I'm never going unless we drive there because I'm not getting in that plane.
Yes, I know. We'll drive.
Giving me a panic attack.
Oh, this is my fault.
Oh, no, it is your fault.
You're ridiculous.
Mother Effer takes a picture of himself standing in front of the plane he's going to get in to fly home. Now, puts it on Instagram, Linoleum Cast on Instagram, by the way, of which I used to have about a 50% controlling stake in, and now it's just all you.
You don't bother anymore. You do it all at D. Leland Weiss.
Yeah. Get in there. Look, here's the picture. You looking kind of like, here I am about to get an airplane. And here's the airplane with propellers like it's 1928. And then it's also a real small airplane. Those are buffeted about in the wind.
Oh, for God's sake.
Quite frequently. I know this. I was on one time. The one time.
This is an Alaska Airlines plane. You make it sound I was getting into some rickety glider or something.
There's more compositional elements to discuss in this photo.
Uh-huh.
Overhead, black clouds. And I'm like, okay, good. I'm going to have a panic attack for the next 90 minutes. While I worry that my husband is going to be dead today.
That is on you. That is on you. Those planes are safer than jets because, you know what?
How do you figure that?
Because if there's an engine failure, at least these planes are built on a glider principle. Jets are built on a rocket principle.
Why do you hear about the small planes always crashing? Why are they the ones that crash?
They all crash. I mean, big planes crash too. But a lot of small planes don't crash, and of course you don't hear about
those. And you just said it. They all crash.
And you knew this.
Hence, I don't like to be in them. Small, big, middle-sized, doesn't matter.
We're not going to go back over your entire years.
We're not.
Of phobia
we
therapy.
We are not.
You know what? We have
never take another photograph like that again in a place where I can see it. Do you want to keep it to yourself until you land safely? Don't put me in a conniption for like 90 minutes great. It was a good marriage. We did love, and now
I did
he's
not,
gone.
I did not know you were going to be such a old lady about this.
Yes, I am, and I always have been, and I always will be.
Fine.
One little old worried lady.
Fretful.
I get worried when you go on any kind of airplane. I spend your flight being like, hope he lands. Hope he lands. Hope he lands. Hope everything's okay. Text me. What do I always say? Text me when you land.
Which I always do.
And you always do.
And you know what? It means I always land.
So far.
Do you even know anybody firsthand who was in a plane crash?
Firsthand?
Yes.
How about friend of friend?
Nope. Firsthand.
Two friends of friends died in 9/11 on those planes.
That doesn't count. I'm talking about...
And that's a weird thing to know. Like, to know two people who lost good friends...
Right.
...in those planes...
I'm not counting
that. That's statistically bizarre.
Exactly. I'm saying statistically, you don't know anybody firsthand who has been in a plane crash. And yet, everybody you know, or many of the people that you know, fly all the time. Think about all the people we know who, because of their jobs or because they love to travel or whatever else, are constantly flying. And yet, here they are, uncrashed.
I don't think about them. I think about you. I concentrate on
you. Well, thank you.
How you like that? How you like that?
The Ella Fitzgerald version of that came on the last time I was getting a haircut. And I was like, this is nice. It's not the Lena Horne.
I know. I know you like that one the best.
Well, because Lena Horne makes it... a beat, and everybody else makes it all very slow and, you know, sad.
Whichever version fills you with the most love for me is the one I want you to be listening to. It's a song, by the way. That was the joke there.
Yes.
Okay, we have 5 films to talk about.
Yes, only one of which we both saw.
We both saw Solo.
And we'll get to that.
You saw more Solo than I did.
Yes, apparently.
You saw The Seagull. Also,
yes.
You saw RBG.
Yes. And then you saw...
I saw the Egyptian film In the Last Days of the City.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw the reissued Cold Water from Olivier Assayas.
Which has never played in the U.S. before, apparently.
Never released in the United States, but we'll get to that.
Yeah, which I wish I'd seen that with you.
I want you to kick it off... with RBG. Well,
okay.
You'll have your chance with Cold Water because it comes out on Blu-ray sometime this year.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
RBG premiered at Sundance this year. It's a documentary about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and she has an amazing life story. You know, she was part of the first class at Harvard Law that allowed women to enter, and apparently there was a dinner where the dean had like the 15 women in the class, you know, sat them down and basically asked them one by one why they were taking a space that a man could have had.
No.
Yes.
Holy crap.
And then...
What
like,
year was this?
Like, 50s.
Okay.
And then her husband had cancer and was getting treatments. And so she is, like, doing her law school, like, second-year law school stuff. She's putting together all of his third-year law school notes that, you know, his friends are collecting for him from class so he can keep up with things. And raising their infant daughter
right.
at the same time. Like,
right.
this woman's just a superhero. It's amazing.
In the tiny little body of a bird.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then she graduates law school. And, of course, no firms want to hire her because she is a woman. And she winds up working with the ACLU and doing all these really groundbreaking gender discrimination cases, including actually one fought on behalf of a man who was a stay-at-home dad, you know, who his wife wasn't getting the same allowances for whatever that men would get for their wives.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it was all about women's rights, but she was very actively tackling gender discrimination wherever it
right.
befell. Usually women were the victims. In this case, it was a man. And then, you know, her husband really lobbied all these people to get Clinton to consider her for the Supreme Court. And then, you know, Bill Clinton actually met her and was, you know, putty in her hands, apparently.
Right.
It is the kind of contemporary documentary that has nothing bad to say about its subjects.
Well, yeah.
You know, there have been a lot of them lately. You know, the Joan Rivers one and the Elaine Stritch and the Carol Channing. And,
right.
You know, there have been a lot of documentaries that are like, isn't this person amazing?
Right.
Aren't they great? Don't yes. you love her?
Right.
And yeah, you know, she's amazing. and I did not know that she was tight friends with Scalia.
How?
Who knows?
Does the film explain why?
They sort of touch on it, but I mean, it's just, I was still baffled by it. But apparently, yeah, they shared a lot in common, even though they had completely diametrically opposed opinions on the court. But they talk about, like, her arguments for the Supreme Court before she was a justice, and how she is now, like, the queen of the very elaborately spelled out, you know, dissent.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a fascinating documentary, and she's, you know, you get to see her watch Kate McKinnon do Ginsburg for the first time.
Yes.
Because she'd never seen it, she doesn't watch TV.
Right.
And that was funny.
She doesn't watch TV.
No. She loves opera.
How's she going to watch Judge Judy and learn how to be a judge?
Yeah, she would hang with you, because she's a big opera fan.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Did they talk about... Okay, well, I've been thinking, like, in the back of my head, I got to catch up on RBG. I got to go down to the movie palace and check out RBG. But I just keep not having a spare 90 minutes.
I know the feeling.
And the... but now I got to know more about this.
Yeah.
Because if she's my opera pal...
Yeah.
Then...
She sits in better seats than you do, though.
Oh, does she?
Oh, yeah.
Does she go to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion?
No.
And sit in the nice loge?
The Founders Circle?
Or the Founders Circle?
No, she goes to Kennedy Center and sits, I'm sure, wherever she dang pleases.
True. Also, here's the thing. Someone that small could fit into those teeny tiny balcony seats that I always wind
That's
up in.
That's true. They're
and
really
be
comfortable.
Really comfortable.
Yeah.
Unlike me. She should trade seats with a large, fat man.
Yeah. Like, she could fly coach.
I
and
just
be,
think that would be fine.
She could fly coach and
it
be,
would be
perfectly
just.
Fine.
She's a justice. It would be just.
But yeah, no, I recommend it. It's just one of those kind of fascinating, like, 20th century stories where you see how quickly things changed in a relatively short amount of time, you know.
How do we feel, you and I, we have not discussed this mm-hmm. ever, I'm just throwing this out at you. How do we feel about treating a Supreme Court justice like a rock star? Do you think that's appropriate?
I think in the case, I think in her case, she is somebody who is,
She's become a symbol, I know that.
yes, she is for the people, you know, she is a ride on sister. And so I am okay with that. I think that, you know, if we look at the history of the court, a lot of progressive strides in this country, you know, obviously a lot of them come from the street level and move their way upward, but the Supreme Court plays a big role in making that stuff happen. I mean, when you and I got, you know, fake married in 1997, our, you know, marital relations were illegal in many states in this country.
That's right.
You know, to say nothing of the fact that we couldn't actually get
It was
married.
real Jean Genet back then. We were sex outlaws.
But now, I mean, obviously, thanks in great part to activists and, you know, people, you know, in the world, but ultimately, thanks to the Supreme Court, you know, pushing the button, now we have joint taxes.
By the way, I didn't say Jean Benet. I said Jean
Jean
Genet.
Genet.
So go look that up if you
Genet.
gotta. All right. No, I do. I
You
really
should
want to get
see
to
it.
this. All right, now. Me, I have a little story to tell you first
About three bad brothers you know so
about cold water,
well? Okay.
l'eau froide. Did I say it right?
You did.
Okay, great. French film from Olivier Assayas. Now, while you were at Mammoth, Cold Water was in its second week of its 2-week run at the Royal.
Really? Why didn't we go see it before I went to Mammoth?
Neither one of us had a moment. There was, as you recall, I did talk to you about this, and I said, "What day do we have to go see this?" And I was like, and you said, "I have a screening here, and I have a podcast there, and I have to go down to the Max Fun Studio, and I have to go to Outfest, and I have to go to What the Flick, and I got to blah 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 blah." And I was like, "I too have many other directional places that I have to be in. We will not see Cold Water together."
Generally speaking, if you're wondering why I haven't seen a particular movie, it's because of blah, 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 blah.
But its second week, they put it on an abbreviated schedule. The two least convenient times of the day for most people, 10:30 in the morning and 10:15 at night.
Good.
So I email.
But you never met a 10:30 a.m. screening you didn't like.
Though that's correct, because I love to do that. Who doesn't love to do that is all of our friends. I text four of them specifically. And I say, "All right, here's what's happening Saturday morning. I'm going to get up. I'm going to go out to Santa Monica. I'm going to have some pastries and Huckleberry, the fancy pastry place. I deserve fancy pastries before I see the French movie. They open at 8 o'clock. The movie's at 10:30 in the morning. Who's with me?"
By the way, our listener Donut Chris made the Huckleberry cornbread in a
Oh,
pan. It
yeah.
looked gorgeous.
It's really good. What was I talking about?
Who's
Oh,
with
yes,
me?
our dumb friends.
Yes.
"I'm gonna go do this thing anyway.
Right.
I'm getting up on Saturday morning. I'm gonna go eat breakfast. I'm gonna go see this movie. I could do this alone and happily.
Right.
I love solo expeditions, right?"
As long as they aren't too solo.
Correct. We'll talk about that in a minute. Here's why I love our friends. The next 2 days involve nonstop complaining. "Why does it have to be so early in the morning? Why do we have to go to Huckleberry? Why are you always doing this to us?"
As though you
I'm
were.
like, I didn't make the movie theater show the movie at 10:30 in the morning.
And.
That wasn't a thing they consulted upon with
And
me.
as though you were like crowdsourcing your
I
plans. It's
know,
like,
yeah.
I'm doing this. You
I'm
can
doing
come
this
or you
anyway.
cannot come, you know.
And then it's like, "Why do you always insist on Huckleberry?" Because it's 5 minutes away from the movie theater.
And it's
And it's
Huckleberry.
Huckleberry, and it's really good. We finally ironed it all out.
Oh, good.
We ate at Norm's. Listen, I love norms. I love norms.
I love the idea of norms.
Nope, norms is delicious. And also, there is nothing for you there that's good for you.
Well, that's the part I like, but...
Anyway, so we go to the movie. And, then there's, you're like, where are we going to sit? Which seats are better? So this movie, now that story's over, this movie's fantastic. If it happens to be playing in a theater, an art house near you, please do go. 1993.
Why don't you explain a little?
Do that right now. 1993, Olivier Assayas made this film. He was almost 40 when he made this movie.
Oh, wow.
But he... But he somehow managed to make this perfect teen document.
What was he doing before he was a filmmaker?
He was a critic at Cahiers.
Oh, one of those.
And then he was a filmmaker. Okay. Now, this was his fourth or fifth film.
Oh, I see.
By that point. And I haven't seen the earlier ones.
I thought this was his first film.
Yeah. Okay. I think this was the first time that he got one into Cannes. It played at Cannes. When it arrived, and thanks to music rights clearances and the horrible fate of films that dare to use popular music and then wind up unreleased on DVD, unreleased in certain countries, released on DVD with new music that doesn't fit. You remember 16 Candles, all that?
Yeah. That's the one I always think about. I remember that Korean movie 301, 302 that really used that Us 3 song well, and then they didn't put it on the video.
Right. So the this got held up and never opened in the United States. Meanwhile, Olivier Assayas' career blows up.
Yeah.
He becomes one of the most, you know, well-known and well-regarded French filmmakers.
He's the Irma Vep guy in Summer Hours and...
Demon Lover and you name, like, The Personal Shopper last year. Clouds of Sils Maria the year before that. Yeah. And the man who single-handedly reminded the world, oh yeah, Kristen Stewart is an actress and quite good at it as well. So, I mean, she did this on
her own. I was going to say, but he helped. He won her a César.
He gave her the venue to...
Yeah.
Hey, everybody, I'm not a joke, you know. Don't want to give him too much credit.
No, of course. So, she's done fascinating work for a lot of different people.
That is correct. This is a film about teenagers in 1972. It stars... a young man who had never acted before, Cyprien Fouquet, and a very young Virginie Ledoyen.
Hmm.
She went on to do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
This was one of her earlier films. This Cyprien Fouquet guy, he, late 2000s, he just sort of stopped.
Hmm.
I don't know what he does now, but he had never been an actor. He sort of just popped around, you know, for a while after that, but she's currently starring in a film that's playing in France right now, and the only reason I know this film exists because it has not opened in the U.S. and maybe won't, we don't know, but Manola Dargis of the New York Times, friend of the show,
yes,
took a photo of the poster while she was in Cannes and put it on her Instagram. Virginie Ledoyen is now in a film in France called MILF.
It's a spin-off of MILF Island.
I need to see MILF.
Well, you know, there was years ago, there was a French teen comedy, I think, called LOL.
Mm-hmm.
They got remade in English with Miley Cyrus and then, like,
and it
was
sank
buried.
Like, sank like a stone.
Yeah.
So anyway. these two kids.
This was Virginie Ledoyen in her pre-MILF period.
Very much so. This is 25 years ago.
Right.
Two kids, two teenagers, They are both very good looking.
This is like, that's like a decade before Eight Women, even, and she was still an ingenue in that. Yeah,
they come from, you know, not happy homes.
Mm-hmm.
They shoplift. She gets arrested. He gets away. And then her parents, she's already been trouble at home. Her parents put her into a mental facility, a mental institution. She escapes. And then she runs off and meets him at an abandoned chateau.
Tonight is what it means to be young.
In the country. And here comes the second, the big, you know, centerpiece of the film. Very long sequence of a bunch of kids in this abandoned chateau having a blowout party jam.
Like the end of Summer Hours? Only destructive?
Not like the end of Summer Hours, because at the end of Summer Hours, those kids are pretty chill.
Mm-hmm.
These kids are like the 1972 French version of Project X.
Ah.
They wind up building a Busby Berkeley-style bonfire.
Oh, my.
And throwing antique furniture into it. Meanwhile, the music is blasting through the soundtrack of all these, like, really cool 1972, you know, songs.
Me and You and a Dog Named Boo.
Not that one, because that was not a very cool song. You know, they smoke pot. They all, like, you know, lie around the place. Then the two kids leave the party, and they're going to run away together. And they're going to run away to a place where she's heard about from a friend, where it's an artist commune, and there's no electricity and running water, but it's out in the middle of nowhere, and everyone just does their thing, man. And he goes along with her. And then some stuff happens. I won't spoil that. Narratively, it's very much in the new wave, post-new wave school of things are just happening and the camera's flying all around. And, you know, there's not much of a story other than teen misery. These are unhappy kids. And they can't get anyone in their adult world to listen, take them seriously, pay attention to them.
They're the younger siblings of the children of Marx and Coca-Cola.
They are, in fact, and that's very important here because it's very much an autobiographical story about Esaias, who came of age just at that time. Like,
we missed 1968.
We missed 1968, and we're teens, and we're kind of cranky about that.
Right.
Now, the film that he made a few years ago, Après May, which in the United States was released under the title Something in the Air.
Oh, yeah. I love that one.
Is about a similar set of circumstances where you've got, it's the early 70s, and you've got somewhat older kids, all of whom are really intellectually engaged and really artistically engaged, and all of whom want to continue
the revolution,
the revolutionary ideas of 1968, but who one by one sort of fall by the wayside. Yeah. These are younger kids who are just disaffected, and they love the rebellion of it all. They want to party, but they don't have formed ideas.
The political underpinning.
They're just upset, you know, like you are when you're a teenager.
Sure.
But they have more reasons to be upset.
Yeah.
It is a thrilling film.
Hmm.
This beautiful, like synthesis of image and sound and music and action and pretty people. Mm-hmm. I loved it, and it's a bummer, but it's also significant. It's considered one of his best films, and I can see why. You know, it's got this great burst of energy. And a really wonderful grasp of how to communicate ideas and emotions just with sound and image. Like, I don't remember very many memorable lines of dialogue other than, the boy's father looking at a piece of art with him, and I can't remember now, I think it was a Caravaggio, and saying, you know, I've never been more moved by an image of suffering. And meanwhile, the kid's like, hello, I'm right here. I'm an image of suffering. I'm like right next to you.
Right.
Yeah. So it's mostly the fullness of the experience, the totality of
the gestalt,
the music and the sound and the
images.
The images. And there's just such beautiful shots. Like Gary, who works as a first AD on TV and film, he was like, that sequence where the kid rides the bike through the fog and the sun's going down. And he was like, how did they plan that? I go, maybe they didn't plan that. But it's hypnotic. It's it'll be out on Blu-ray by the end of the year, and we will cover the window so there's no glare on the TV, and we will watch it.
A good.
I'll watch it again. No problem.
All right.
Yeah. Cold Water. Seek it out.
Yes. Which you will not be watching again. Not that you watched it.
I won't even be watching it in full.
Solo, A Star Wars Story. So you left.
I walked out.
You walked out.
You know what? I bought a ticket. It's my right.
Yeah.
If I were reviewing it, and we were at a press screening,
yeah,
obviously I would stay till the bitter end of the last frame of the credits.
Right.
But I bought my damn ticket. And halfway through it, when What's-Her-Face from Game of Thrones says, oh, Kessel, blah, 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 I thought, I already know how this ends.
Well, that's the thing.
It's like, I know how this ends.
I was thinking about...
Now I'm going to leave.
As much as...
I actually left at about the two-hour mark. It had about 20, 25 minutes left.
Mm.
But I was so out of my mind with boredom that I thought, no.
We complained...
I'm leaving, goodbye.
We complained for decades about sequels. You know, I remember Ebert, like, his definition of a sequel was a filmed deal. But prequels are worse.
They are, often. Because, I don't know if there's a good one that I'm not thinking of right now.
Well, but. I mean, the one I've been pointing to lately, as far as like how to do it right, is Better Call Saul. Better Call Saul takes place before Breaking
What's that
Bad.
Insidious, the Insidious movie that takes place before, and it's all about Lin Shaye. What's that one?
Three, I think.
Insidious, the Lin Shaye one?
Yeah.
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 That didn't bother me too
That was
much.
Entertaining. Yeah, I mean, yeah. Okay, prequels aren't, I'm not saying they're automatically bad, but... For the most part, especially in something like, in such established, you know, poured over canon as Star Wars, it's all about Kessel, Millennium Falcon, right. You know, like, you right. know what this is, right. you know what this is, right. pat yourself on the back, because you know what this is.
Right.
And I was thinking, like, if you made a sequel to Citizen Kane, where you see...
The Kane.
Like, young... where you see young Jed and Charlie get kicked out of, you know, fancy schools.
Right.
Or you see Susan Alexander's mother telling her, oh, I wish you would sing opera one day.
Right.
Or you see Wheeler in Cuba, you know, writing prose poems. That doesn't tell you anything that you didn't already know about these characters. It's just you registering, oh, that's a thing that happens later.
Right.
And there is nothing in Solo that tells you anything you didn't know about Han Solo or Lando Calrissian or Chewbacca, except Chewbacca's age, maybe. You know, it's just...
How many hundred years old is he?
He's 190 in this
Okay,
one,
yeah.
Which Nathan Raven tweeted. So I find it hard to believe that a 203-year-old would be that upset about missing Life Day. but, you know, it doesn't... There's... There's no.
Did I miss a hologram B. Arthur?
Sadly, no.
Okay, well then I'm glad I walked out.
There's no deepening of these characters, and not even, and they're maybe like, you know, characters. Who are we kidding? Like he's a swashbuckling space pirate. Like,
yes.
This isn't Hamlet we're talking about here. So you know, I don't know what Lord and Miller might have done with this, but
in something fun, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, they given their track record, yes. Right. In the hands of Ron Howard, it just all feels very kind of safe and perfunctory. There's a couple of big action sequences that are pretty cool, but they're both too long. There's a heist on like a monorail that's exciting, but then it keeps going. The Kessel Run is exciting, but then it keeps going, and half of it's very confusing. You missed the Kessel Run. There's a whole weird aspect of that. I'm like, what's even happening now? I know you didn't like Alden Ehrenreich's wig, but how did you like his performance?
Hang on. I'm about to list the things I don't like.
Okay.
Then I'll talk about the couple things I did like.
Okay.
All right. I didn't like Alden Ehrenreich's hair. I don't know if that was his actual hair that they styled into a Final Net bulletproof mold, or if it was a wig. I suspect it was a wig, because it never moved.
Mm.
And they were going for something that looked vaguely like it would become Han Solo's, you
Faradu.
Know, yeah, 70s, you know, shag, whatever yeah. it was he had on his head then.
Parted in the middle.
I think Alden Ehrenreich is a really interesting young actor.
Yes.
His performance in Hail Caesar is comedy gold, and
yes.
you should look at it.
No question.
He is not given the chance to do much of anything here other than affect a certain roguishness.
Mm.
I don't know how much of that he has in him quite yet still.
Well, it's a thankless role. But
Donald Glover as Lando Calrissian, on the other hand, is a smooth operator.
Mm-hmm.
And you watch him and you think, nice cape.
He has a Colt 45 for you.
Yeah. Nice cape. Why aren't you the star? Why isn't this film entirely about you?
Yeah.
Was I talking about the things I don't like? Oh, yes, the wig. All right. Now, secondly, what I don't like is the production design, which I think was intended to be a monochromatic yet in color film.
Yes. They're going for sort of a Western dusty brown.
Everything is brown or gray or black or sort of a burnished golden brown in certain scenes. Even when they are not in shadow and darkness, everything is a sort of silver gray, like they're outside during the snowy mm-hmm. train sequence.
Everything's silver, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like I wasn't able to see them very well.
And here's the thing. You know, I keep reading all these articles about how, oh, Bradford Young did such an amazing job shooting this movie. Bradford Young is a genius, and he's shot some really great-looking movies. This is not one of them. And I went to the premiere. Like, you saw it at the Grove, so yeah. Maybe their projector was off or not set to the right thing or whatever.
Possibly.
But I was at the premiere, where presumably somebody from Disney actually, like, made sure that it looked the
Everything
way, it was,
looked
supposed
the way
to look.
It was
supposed to look. And I still thought it was all muddy and
dark and muddy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if there was... Here's my guess. I'm thinking Bradford Young said, let's make it look like a movie that was shot in the 70s. Because so much of that stuff back then, thanks to...
Gordon Willis,
was all shadows and darkness and stuff like that. But I just didn't... It didn't feel right here.
Yeah. If you're going to make a movie look monochromatic and still be in color, like, give me At Long Last Love going for that sort of, like, white, black, and silver deco look, because at least it's bright and it's attractive and I can see what's going on.
I would be willing, perhaps, to look at this again with no sound, just to look at it, just to see what I'm supposed to be seeing.
Yeah.
Because the charm of this, the artistry of this really did bypass me. I know they meant to do that, but I don't know why it looks that way now. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, like, it was clearly an intentional choice.
Absolutely.
But I don't, but what was the point of it? No, I totally agree with you.
And yeah, the script gives him just, you know, beats to, you know, like little pots of gold in a video game to uncover. Like, oh, you got that one. You got that one. You got that one. Otherwise, I was really, really
Me too. I was not bored enough to leave, although again, I was at the premiere and that would have been bad form.
Yes.
But yeah, I kept.
No one noticed when I left because it was in a nearly empty theater, the
Yes,
big
well.
house at the Grove, and there were maybe 20 people in the
And yeah,
place.
you went like on Memorial Day. It
And I
is.
was on the last row in the back, and five, six rows in front of me,
Yeah.
nobody was there.
The internet now is all full of theories of why is this one underperforming? And, maybe because the last Star Wars movie came out 5 months ago.
Right. Give me a chance to miss you.
Yes, Star
They're
Wars
not
and.
putting one out this Christmas, are they?
I don't think so.
Why didn't this one come out this
I
Christmas?
don't know. I think maybe he's. Who knows? I don't know. I couldn't tell
That's.
you.
I want to know these
Star Wars
things.
and Terrence Malick need to slow their roll. Be an event again.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, be an event that is worth looking at. This one. I'm willing to hear from people who think it looks amazing. Tell me why.
There's a big article that I haven't clicked on that people keep posting
All
in
right.
like the Chicago one of the Chicago papers where they did a long interview with Bradford Young and Matt Seitz, who always complains that film critics don't talk enough about cinematography and how
Yes, he
movies are
does.
made, said that it's some of the best writing on the subject he's ever seen. And so I meant to click on it, but it's like I don't want to read about the cinematographer
No, I
solo
do.
because I thought it looked
I do because
terrible.
I'm so into that.
All right.
And I feel like it was misapplied to this film. I mean, maybe I'm talking out of my butt. I don't know. I tend to think I know what I'm talking about sometimes, but maybe this time I don't.
Well, that's
Anyway,
the
I hated it. I walked out.
that's the weird thing. Like I read all these opposing opinions. And I'm like, did I miss something? Am I dumb? Or that? But then
Yeah.
I'll read other people who agree with them. Like, okay, no, it's just in how you see things. It's
Right.
still art in terms of how we, take it in and look at it. All right, I'm going to talk about The Seagull real quick. So it is a very safe, for the most part, adaptation of the Chekhov play, and it is a handsome
You
production.
know, I like those.
It's shot in this beautiful lake house and
Yep.
really good cast. Obviously, it's Annette Bening and Elizabeth Moss and Corey Stoll, and the male lead is kind of a pain because that character is already sort of like a drama queen and full of himself, and so you have to act it in a not quite so on the nose way, and this guy does it. There's a small role played by the dude
This
who
guy
is
who?
I forget his name. He's also in On Chesil Beach, which we haven't seen yet. Saoirse Ronan is in this. Well, the
Billy
two,
Howell?
yes, Billy Howell.
Is that who we're talking about?
Yes,
All
he
right.
and Saoirse Ronan are a couple in On Chesil Beach we haven't seen yet, and in this one. Also, Mr. Meisel
He
is in
was in
this one.
Dunkirk as well.
Okay, well, yeah, everyone was in
All the young
Dunkirk.
men were in Dunkirk.
Yes,
Yes.
Mr. Meisel is in this film.
Okay.
That actor. It's fine. There were moments where I was sort of reminded of the way that Woody Allen makes fun of Russian literature in Love and Death.
Right.
There's that part where Jessica Harper says, I'm in love with Misha. Misha's in love with Nina. Nina is in love with Trigorin. Trigorin is in love with, and that's the plot of this, basically, wheat, fields of wheat. For my money, the best screen adaptation of Chekhov is still Vanya on 42nd Street,
Yeah.
which it takes the complete opposite approach as far as
From
like,
the 90s with Julianne Moore.
yes,
Yeah.
yes, which Louis Malle directed,
Yep.
and it's super stripped down. It's all set in this like decrepit theater that was about to be torn down, and it's so alive and the performances are great, but they are. The camera can get right up close, and you don't need a lake, and you don't need a dasha, to make this thing work. And so, I would say if you haven't seen Vanya on 42nd Street, there's a beautiful Criterion Blu-ray. Go check that out. The Seagull is whatever. It's kind of a like if your mom subscribes to PBS, take her to that movie.
See, that sounds like a good time to me.
No, and I'm sure you would enjoy
Because I'm basically a mom who subscribes to
it.
PBS.
It's not, there's nothing necessarily wrong with it. It's
Yeah.
just, there's no effort to do anything remotely daring. There's one sort of narrative thing that happens that's a little bit on the bold side, but for the most part, it's straight up, fancy time masterpiece theater.
Okay, so the last film I have to talk about is called In the Last Days of the City.
Is this another one of those played in town one night deals? Or does it have a just like is there a distributor attached?
There is a distributor attached. However, it is going to be, I'll just say it, it's going to be probably difficult for you to find until it gets
Home video.
a home video DVD streaming situation. It is an Egyptian film. It came to my attention. A publicist sent me an email about it. I just opened up the email. And you and I get
A lot.
a lot of emails about a lot of movies that are opening in, they've got tiny micro distributors, or they're opening day and date, they're streaming, they're not opening in Los Angeles, period. Here's a link, And so many of them don't feel worthy of even getting to, because
They aren't priority,
there are
is the thing.
400, what are the 350, 450 movies that come out every year
Something
in the
like that,
US?
yeah.
Yeah, that's an insane amount of movies. We're lucky, you and I, if we get between 200 and 300 of them seen in the course of a year, and that's
Right.
still a lot.
Yeah.
Like, I think back in the day when I was at movies.com, I was really gunning it. I would see between 250 and 300 a year.
Well, I mean, at iFilm,
I film it was even crazier
you were seeing every single thing that opened in Los
in Los
Angeles.
Angeles, and that was still a lot.
Yeah.
And now there's even more.
Yeah.
So you got to pick and choose. But what caught my attention about this one now is that its initial release in the United States was a week at MoMA in New York. And that always sort of perks, I prick up my ears because I think, well, someone there decided this was worth
Right.
a week-long run.
Like Happy Hour.
Like Happy Hour, that we eventually only saw because of a DVD release.
Right.
It never had a Los Angeles theatrical play date. This is an unusual film. It played in New York for a week at MoMA. It played for a week in Los Angeles at one of the Lemley theaters.
One of our art house
I
chains.
know it's hopping around, college towns, museums, places like that.
Right.
And it might still be
If you live in a city with a large
something like
Egyptian
this.
expat community,
Yeah.
maybe.
Something like this tends to take a very long time to roll out, and they exhaust all the possibilities before they start thinking about a DVD release.
Right.
So I'm guessing this one is still in
Making its way
in
around.
that rolling out situation. It's worth looking for. It is the directorial debut of Egyptian filmmaker Tamer El-Said. Are you having a problem with your microphones or
No,
something, or your sound? What's
I
going
was
on?
trying to turn up my
Is there a
headphones,
hum
and because
that I don't know about?
this is a very crowded table.
Yes, it is. Is
Go.
everything okay?
Yes,
Okay.
go on. I was not trying to interrupt you.
Clonk, bank, bleh. That's me.
Was gonna
You're
say.
being me, hitting the microphone and knocking things over. Stop being me. Debut feature from Egyptian filmmaker Tamer El-Said. It is about a guy, a man named Khalid. This is the actor Khalid Abdallah, who is, I think, Scottish, but who had Egyptian parents,
Okay.
and he spent a lot of time away from his acting career to go down to Cairo, not only to be in this film, but then to participate in the Arab Spring.
Oh.
And so, interestingly enough, this film was shot in 2009, 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And not finished until after all the
right
the chaos in Cairo
right
went down. So this has been a long gestating project, mm-hmm. only now coming out here.
Right.
So he plays a filmmaker.
Mm.
And he's stuck on this very personal documentary. Part of it is, you know, a breakup that he went through. Part of the reason he's stuck is his mother is dying. He's between homes. He's trying to find a new apartment, but nothing is right. And the apartment guy trying to show him apartments is like, you're never satisfied with anything. And the guy's like, I don't know. I just don't feel like I can settle into a place here. Each place he goes, he sees signs of encroaching fundamentalism.
Hmm.
You know, little signs that are translated, little stickers mm-hmm. on things that will then be translated in the subtitles, like, women must not leave the home, you know, like things like that. And so he, every once in a while, he just stares at it. Near the end, he tries to rip one down. And he has three friends who have all left Cairo for various other cities. One's in Berlin, one's in Baghdad. I forget where the other one is. But they all come to visit him. They talk about the film. They decide they're going to send him footage from where they are to help him finish the movie. And so, very much like Cold Water that we were just talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
this is a narrative that lingers and stops and starts, and things that you think are happening in front of your face are really clips of the documentary that he's making. So suddenly something will rewind. You're like, wait, why is that happening? And you realize, oh, it's because it's not happening. It's part of his film. You'll see clips from the other guys, and those clips are just dropped in to the action. And you are expected to keep up. So narratively, you know, it's like that. So, and formally, it can be confusing, but it's a chill kind of confusion. You're not worried that the movie doesn't know what's going on.
Not Twin Peaks season 3.
Right. Correct. What it winds up as is a bit of a very sad travelogue, because the life in Cairo is given equal weight to the life of the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see so much, you know, just street action that goes on. And it was made at a time before things kind of went to hell.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this snapshot of, you know,
the precipice,
restless, you know, artists not knowing what's going to happen, fears for the future, the tension of wondering, is it time to leave?
Mm.
You know, should I pull up stakes and get the hell out of here? And the same,
gee, what's that like?
The same from the Baghdad friend who's like, no, I'm staying in Baghdad. And everyone else is like, you're going to die. And he's like, no, I'm going to be fine. Anyway, so it's lovely.
Huh.
It's really worth your time. You're going to tell your friends about it, and they're going to go, I'm not going to watch an Egyptian movie about trouble in Cairo. Like, and part of me gets that reluctance. Like when you, especially right now in the United States, you think, look, we have our own problems right now in this country. We've got fascists trying to take over. Well, it seems that they have taken over. And I understand that, but I think that, you know, films like this from other places that take you away from your own anxieties about where you live, I think that they help. I think that they can give you
perspective
and maybe some pointers on on what you might have to deal with in the coming years.
Sure.
In this country that you once thought was stable.
Right.
And no longer is. So, In the Last Days of the City. Write that one down if you live somewhere without an art house, or if you live somewhere with an art house that only shows, you know, RBG. You know what I mean.
Yes.
Yeah. Be on the lookout for this one.
You have a DVD pick?
Well, last week I did the It's Alive box.
Yes, you did.
Yesterday in the mail, I don't know if this is coming out this week or next week, but I'm just going to talk about it anyway. I haven't watched it yet, but I'm stoked. It's already sitting on top of Mount Unwatched, and it's got a very lovely picture of Ms. Huppert on the DVD itself, and so that will remind me that I've been wanting to see this since it played for its 1 week run in Los Angeles.
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
Souvenir.
Right.
Is out now from Strand Releasing on DVD or Blu-ray or both. I don't know. Isabelle Huppert plays a woman who works in a factory, and someone in her factory recognizes her as being a former wannabe pop star who sang in the Eurovision Song Contest. And he wants to help her resurrect her career, and she's like, I don't know, okay. So there's a website that I like called, I think it's called the Isle of Deserted Pop Stars. And there's a new podcast that I did called Unflopped. And and both of these are about like people who were going to be pop stars and then they just didn't quite get there. Mm. Or people who had a hit and then that was the end.
What was that? There was some girl group compilation you had where all the guys were
You Can Be Wrong About Boys.
Yes.
Was the name of the compilation I had, yeah.
And all the bios were like, success eluded these young ladies.
The Buttercups or whatever their names were. Yeah, yeah. So I'm obsessed with stuff like that.
Okay.
And Unflopped is this cool show where they talk about, like, maybe people with actual careers mm-hmm. who released singles that went nowhere.
Right.
Like, in honor of Kylie Minogue's 50th birthday this past week, they did a little bit on Twitter that was like, Time Bomb, why was that not a hit? It was a song from Kylie Minogue a few years ago that was a jam, a stone cold jam. And
the single just went nowhere.
It should have been a hit in all the usual suspect countries.
Right.
It was a dance club hit in the United States, but because it's Kylie Minogue, it was not, you know, a hit for her on the radio here, right? Because she's had like four of them. But you would have thought this would have gone to number one everywhere, right?
Why wasn't Luxembourg jamming to this?
Yeah, why wasn't Luxembourg buying Time Bomb, this wickedly awesome song? Who knows why? But anyway, they did a thing devoted to... They did a bit devoted to
Unflopped
that.
Nose.
Unflopped, yes.
I'm going to say, because, you know, I think this... It had a lot of hype, and then it didn't really do all that well. So I think a lot of people maybe still haven't seen Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
And Alden Ehrenreich is a revelation in that movie. He's so kind of daffy and charming and funny, and does these crazy physical things that sort of remind you that... Movie stars used to be able to do things.
Right.
You know, they could dance or they could...
That's why they became movie stars. They were like, oh, you can lasso something? We're going to put you in the movies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So he does these crazy lasso things and stuff. And
he has to learn how to do all that
stuff. Of course, but he does them. Yeah. You know, so it's... Anyway, the movie's fun, but he especially is a standout. And that's hard, you know, in a movie that has... You know, George Clooney and Tilda Swinton and Josh Brolin and Scarlett Johansson and Channing Tatum. It's a big deal to be the standout, you know.
Right.
All right, we have letters, yes?
Maybe.
Don't we?
Perhaps. Here, let me scroll down because you sent them to me...
Several hours ago. And your inbox is just where it's all happening.
My inbox is full of it all the time. Dear Mr.'s Knife, this is from Alan. I have to say I'm surprised by your positive review of A Quiet Place.
Well.
Aside from seeming like an ad for the virtues of homeschooling, the ham-handed way plot points were telegraphed spoiled any tension for me. I mean, the nail that Emily Blunt upends while doing laundry... An inanimate object hasn't received such a loving close-up since the last Scott Eastwood movie. Zing! Mm. And remember that disease Michael Landon had where he knew exactly how much the audience loved to see him suffer and consequently larded Little House on the Prairie with lingering shots of him manfully sweating over some moral quandary about the well-being of his family? Well, it's catching, and John Krasinski has it. Anyway, I have a much longer and less querulous letter I keep meaning to send you gentlemen, thanking you for the excellent podcast and for making me feel like a star for occasionally creeping my Instagram. What do you creep on the Instagram,
I don't
or do
creep,
I?
Creep. I hit like on things okay. sometimes.
But I had to get this off my chest. Manfully yours, Alan. Well, Alan, as one manly chest to another.
I have to say, the further I get from A Quiet Place,
the more you're like, wait a minute.
Yeah. But in the moment, in the best B movie way, it was very effective at doing the thing it wanted to do.
I was thinking about this a couple weeks ago when Matt Seitz showed it to his father.
Mm-hmm.
And his father said, okay, so what's this movie really about? Because every horror movie is about something
sure.
else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, a really good horror movie is about something else.
Of course.
Yeah. So what's this movie about? And I started thinking about it. I was like, okay, so people are... people have been invaded by aliens, being attacked and killed by aliens, if they speak. And then I thought,
oh no.
Oh, wait.
Oh no.
Oh no. I don't want to think about that being what it's about.
I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that they didn't think about it that way. But,
These poor white people just saying things and being attacked.
They can't, they make a sound that just destroys.
Yeah.
Ouch.
I'm sure that that's not what it's supposed to be about. Like, it may just be one of those instances where X equals X.
Mm.
And it's just about monsters that kill you. But I'm never going to not kind of havesies read it like this now.
Well, sure.
Now that I've had a minute to think about it.
And, you know, I mean, Krasinski was in 13 hours.
Oh, do we think he's a secret Trumper?
I don't know.
He's not. I guarantee you.
I know Emily Blunt isn't. She's too cool.
She's too cool.
I don't know.
I'm going to pretend I don't know anything about anyone's politics. Just keep that beard, John Krasinski.
Yes, please.
Make me happy.
What else we got?
Well, I have to scroll back down again.
Oh my God, it's so difficult.
Sorry. Julius of the Solute. THESOLUTE.com. Last night, I was on a date with a guy where we watched two movies that ended up being very bad. The first was his choice. The one that will remain unnamed, as it is an obscure, boring gay film that would immediately specify who I am should he listen to this podcast. The best I can say about it is that it was nominated for multiple Golden Globes. And the Wikipedia articles on the movie and its subject were more interesting than the actual film. What might that have been?
Call Me By Your Name? Milk?
I don't know. But the second movie was my choice. The Book of Henry! Now, I've seen this movie before and knew it was certifiably insane. I've since decided that this might be a good litmus test movie. Dude, I'm so with you on that.
Oh yeah, it's like John Waters used to show Boom to people, and if they didn't, you know, if they didn't get it, he would not sleep with them.
In previous dating scenarios, I have used Pink Flamingos and Showgirls.
Yeah.
I wanted his honest reaction to it, so if something hilariously inappropriate would pop up, I would shove my wild, crazy grin into some body part or other and see how he was reacting. He didn't really react to the movie, except for the spoiler. Question mark. talent show climax when the younger brother resurrects his brother through a steamer trunk of confetti. Which, if he didn't react to that, I'd have to check his pulse. The final reaction I got was, that was interesting. Not even one of those polite, interesting means bad intonations. Just an, I'm still processing this movie intonation. He later said that the Book of Henry messed with his dreams and put him in a weird headspace the morning after. So I guess this leaves a couple of questions on the table. Number one, is it appropriate to do media litmus tests on a date?
Oh, totally. Yes. Yes.
I mean, tastes don't have to be exact, but I would like to date somebody with a modicum of overlap in media preference.
Oh, yeah. No, look, scan their books, look at their DVD collection.
And number two, if someone doesn't find the Book of Henry insane, are they dateable?
No.
If you can watch the Book of Henry and not walk away from it and go, that was insane, then you think about the world in a different way than I do.
Yeah. That's too wide a gap.
And I do believe in the litmus test.
Oh, totally.
And I do believe in keeping it a secret.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Years later over the fire. Spring the it on fire, you can
oh,
laugh
yeah.
at it, but, you know.
Spring it on them. Litmus test I took you on that night out of seeing local bands in Fort Worth. And you were a trooper. And they sucked. All those bands were bad. And you were a trooper. You were like, that was fun. Later on, I was playing like some Sonic Youth, something or other. And you were real chill about it. You were like, I'm not really a fan of them, but I get why they are what they are and why they do what they do. And right then I thought, I'm going to put a ring on this. Congratulations. You're the first person I've met who was a gay man in Dallas, Texas, who didn't run screaming from literally every piece of music or film or book or television program that I put in front of him.
I remember being impressed by the fact that we went to see an art house movie, and then afterwards you admitted that you didn't get it.
Which one was that?
The Mystery of Rompo.
God, I still hate that movie.
You didn't hate it, though. You just didn't get it.
Like, yeah, I walked out of it going, I have no idea what that was.
And I started talking about it. You were like, okay. Oh, I guess that's what it was. And I was like, at least that you were able to cop to it and didn't feel like you had to, you know, fake like you did get it.
No.
That was like, all right.
Listen. I'm confident in my ability to get the art house movie.
Yes.
And I'm seasoned. But every once in a while, you know, one will come along and be like, I have no idea what I just watched. I have no idea what I just watched.
What was that?
Yeah. Oh, those first couple Strobe-Wier films, I was like, I don't know what's happening. This is an entirely different rhythm, different filmmaking language, different. I don't know what these people are doing. I need to think harder. Watch these movies again. Read about them. That's how you learn things.
Indeed.
That is how you learn stuff. And so, and anybody who says, oh, you should be able to get it right away without anyone's help, you're full of...
Shut up.
Yeah. One of our friends said that to me once.
What?
I'll tell you later.
I bet I know.
I'll tell you later who it was.
I bet I know.
And so... I knew while dating Les back in the early 90s before I ever met you, I knew that he and I were just going to be sex.
because his favorite movies were The Bodyguard and
you
Funny
are
Girl?
A giant lummox who looks real good as that giant lummox. And your favorite movie is The Bodyguard?
No.
And you want to watch Home Alone 2 with me? What are you...
A Funny Girl, right? Wasn't that a...
Funny Girl is all-time favorite. Now, that I can respect.
Sure.
But he was a maniac for it. Like, it was always on... It was always in his VHS player.
Oof.
Always. Like, he would get up in the morning and pop it in just for a few minutes while he was eating breakfast. Like, I just can't get enough. Yeah.
I'm putting
him on blast, I know, but he's not even listening to this, no. So it doesn't matter. And he's a delight.
He's
and
a
we're
sweetheart.
We're still friends. And he caught the bouquet at our 1997 wedding that we threw off the balcony of the movie theater, and he elbowed your ex-boyfriend out of the way for
your ex decked my ex to get to that
bouquet. Okay, well, here's what. My ex is 6'4 and 330 pounds, and yours was 5'4 and 130 pounds.
Fine, but you know what? My ex got married, so even not catching the bouquet, he's fine.
Les is a single lady to this day.
Yes.
He's dateable, gentlemen.
That's right.
Go find him.
He's on the market.
Yeah.
We got one more letter.
We do. Anyway, yes to litmus tests. Yes to dumping by the wayside anyone who doesn't...
takes Book of Henry seriously.
Now, it may take them a little time. You may have a thing where the guy's like, this movie has messed with my headspace. And then like a week or a month later, he's like, that movie was out of its head, right? I'm not crazy. That movie's crazy, right? Like, it may be a grower kind of situation.
Maybe. Yeah. He's got to sit with it for a while.
Yeah. Anyway. One more email. Dr. Steve Scott. Dear Linoleum Knife, is Love, Simon a Christmas movie? Love. Golden Bear. What the hell is that? What is that question?
I know where it's coming from.
Where is it coming from?
There are movies that employ Christmas mainly to indicate that a year is passing.
Okay.
So
I don't remember there being any Christmas in Love,
there's
Simon.
There's a Christmas in Love, Simon.
When? What?
It's a thing. In fact, doesn't he like come back to them on Christmas morning or something?
I can't remember.
Anyway. It is often...
That movie is the sweet, lovely equivalent of a bowl of warm buttered toast all torn up into pieces and warm milk poured over it that I eat for breakfast.
That my mommy made for me. Yes. No, it's adorable. And it is now out on home video, by the way, so pick up Love, Simon. Christmas is often employed in movies as a marker to let you know that, like, a school year is happening, or that time is passing. You know, think of, like, when Harry met Sally. You know, we see the two of them take the tree home, and then the next year she has to struggle with the tree by herself.
Or that Dawn Davenport did not get her cha-cha heels.
Well, that's less of a... I mean, that's a great Christmas scene, but that's not so much... That movie's not so much about the showing the passage.
You put it in your Christmas movie book.
Yes, but you're not. This is not what we're talking about right now, this second.
Okay.
This second, I'm talking about movies that use Christmas passing as a way to let you know that calendar pages are flipping.
All right.
Love, Simon is doing that. So it is not a Christmas movie per se. It does have a Christmas sequence in it. Not a particularly memorable one, unlike the one in Female Trouble. So you could count it if you felt like it, but it is. I put it more in the sort of, it's a calendar thing.
Well, all right.
Okay. Hey, thank you all for listening. And if you like this...
then you would perhaps like to join our Patreon subscription situation.
Mm-hmm.
You would become a member of our club. The club is named Linoleum Knife. It's also the name of this podcast. Don't be confused.
Everything is Linoleum Knife.
If you go to Patreon and type in Linoleum Knife, everything will be explained to you.
Patreon.com/Linoleum Knife.
It costs a varying amount of money. Whatever you're into.
For a varying amount of stuff.
Things. Oh my goodness, I just packaged up a box of prizes to South Africa.
Woo!
Yeah. We have a subscriber in South Africa.
Hello, you.
Anton.
Hello, Anton.
Actually, he's not in South Africa at the moment.
Ah.
He's working in
getting mail there.
He's working in another country. He's from South Africa.
I see.
Yeah.
Oh, before I forget... M.A. Ross tagged me on Facebook to list my 10 favorite albums. I'm not doing that.
What does that have to do with this podcast? Other than that you know he's listening.
I know he's listening. I just figured this is the easy way to tell him. But I appreciate the thought. Anyway, patreon.com.
Why won't you tell people your 10 favorite albums? What's your problem?
I don't feel like it.
Why not?
It's not. No one needs to know.
The Partridge Family. Sound Magazine.
Those are your top.
That's a good one.
Anyway,
Black Flag, Damaged.
At Patreon, you get extra content, you get prizes, you get hangouts, you get things and stuff, and so you should go check that out.
Maybe you think I'm going to say Daydream Nation. Yes, but Bad Moon Rising is really the one.
Okay, fine.
Yeah.
Anyway, Patreon.
Double nickels on the dime.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. Think about it, won't you?
I've listed four. I've only got six more to go.
You can do this on Facebook or whatever.
What else?
Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And you know what? My top 10 albums might include Blue's Redhead.
Might it?
Yes, it might. Also, check out ChristyLemire.com. Go listen to Bibbs and Whitney's two shows, Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed on the Schmoes Know Network. And, of course, check out the Schmoes Know while you're there. Listen to Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley, All Things Cozy, The Comics Canon, Sewers of Paris, and Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, Apple Podcasts, rather. And leave us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts. We would really appreciate it, and we will read them on the show when we get them. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, like Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com, and Spotify, and Google Play, and Podbean, and CastBox, and iVoox, and
Podflorp.
Exactly.
Yes.
Podflorp. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Listen to me every week on Who Shot Ya? And again, patreon.com/linoleumknife. You'll be glad you did. We'll be back soon with more. But until then,
goodbye.